Let's open up the regular meeting for Eastern Municipal Water District's Board of Directors, this being July the 15th, 2020, just a little after 9:00 a.m. Dave Slosson, would you lead us in the pledge, please?
Everyone, please stand and join me in the pledge of our flag. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Secretary, could we have a roll call, please, for the attendance?
Director Polly?
I'm present.
Director Corona?
Here.
Director Slosson?
Here.
Director Record?
Here.
And so for the record, we'll let Director Record is called in this morning. Do we have any introductions of guests this morning?
We do not have any guests in the room this morning.
Terrific. Okay. This being the time, and this agenda item one is for public comments, and any subject within the jurisdiction of EMWD, speakers are required to limit comments to 3 minutes. I don't believe that we have any in the present audience. I don't believe there's anyone on the phone.
Yes, there is. Chris Clark with the National Parks Conservation Association.
Yes.
Should I go now?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for the ability to comment. I hope that all of you are doing well. It's nice to hear some familiar voices. My name's Chris Clark. I am Director of the California Desert Program for the National Parks Conservation Association. It's been my pleasure to talk to you previously about the Cadiz Project. NPCA appreciates that this board has shown no particular interest in this hypothetical and controversial water source. The last 2 years have been quite disadvantageous for Cadiz, with rejection by other water districts, published peer-reviewed science that shows the project will drain aquifers and damage springs, and the passage of SB 307 in July 2019, which established protection standards for the desert's natural and cultural resources that Cadiz cannot meet. As a PR attempt to counter these pieces of bad news, Cadiz is paying the Three Valleys Municipal Water District a little bit more than $800,000 to hire a consultant who's a longtime Cadiz advocate, conduct yet another study of the impact of the project on the desert. Cadiz and Three Valleys hope to influence the State Lands Commission, which under SB 307 must certify that the project will not harm desert cultural or natural resources before it can move forward. The commission and its staff are well aware of what's going on, and the bogus Cadiz Three Valleys study will be dead on arrival when it's completed in 2021. Based on these and other factors, our conclusion is that the Cadiz project is dead and that Eastern Municipal Water District has many more environmentally friendly approaches available, from conserving water, where landscaping is a huge opportunity, as far as it goes to increasing local supply. We would like the opportunity to talk with each of you about the district's water future sometime in the near future, hopefully, if conditions permit, in person. And we will be in touch soon. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you this morning.
Oh, wait, thank you very much for your comments, and we'll look forward to the follow-up on meeting with EMWD. All right, any other public comments? Hearing none, let's go to agenda item two, which is reserved for public hearings. This is the time and the place for a duly noticed public hearing regarding collection of annual sewer charges for sewer-only accounts on the property tax rolls for fiscal year commencing in July 1, 2020. I declare this public hearing open and would ask staff report on the proposed action.
Thomas. July 2015, the board adopted ordinance 2015-003, which established the collection of annual sewer charges on the property tax roll for sewer-only accounts. These are sewer accounts not connected to the EMWD water system. In fiscal year 2019-20, the district levied 133 parcels for a total assessment amount of $65,053.98. As of June 30th, 2020, the district has received 64,320 $1,000.93 of these assessed charges. This equates to a very low delinquency rate of just 1.13%. The district will levy 132 parcels for the 2020-21 tax year for a total assessment amount of $66,516.56. All charges have been calculated in the same manner as non-sewer-only accounts in accordance with consolidated schedule of rates, fees, and charges. Staff has prepared a sewer-only accounts special assessment report per Health and Safety Code 5473 attached as Exhibit B. This report identifies each of the parcels to be levied as well as their calculated annual sewer charge and was filed with the Board Secretary on June 17, 2020 upon adoption of Resolution 2020-094.
Thank you. I would ask the Secretary of the Board how this hearing was noticed.
The sewer-only accounts special assessment report was filed with the Secretary on June 17, 2020. Notice of the filing of the report proposing to have annual sewer charges for the upcoming fiscal year collected on the tax roll and of the time and place of this hearing was published in the Press Enterprise, a local newspaper, on June 30th and July 7th, 2020, in accordance with the Government Code Section 6066.
If the Secretary of the Board has received any written protest to the proposal, I would ask her to provide copies thereof to the Board.
No written protests to the proposal have been received.
Thank you. Since members of the public have been invited to participate in this hearing telephonically, I would ask that any members of the public who would like to comment on this item, please do so. Please state your name and address for the record before commenting. Seeing none, I hereby declare this public hearing closed. There have not been any protests made for the owners of the majority of the separate parcels of property described in the report, and the board now has the option to adopt, revise, change, reduce, or modify any changes in the report. If no revisions are requested, we are ready to adopt the following resolution. The resolution of the Board of Directors of Eastern Municipal Water District approving the collection of annual sewer charges for sewer-only accounts on the property tax rolls for the fiscal year commencing July 1, 2020. I will accept a motion and a second to adopt the resolution and the associated report.
I'll make that motion.
I will second the motion.
Okay, that motion has been moved and seconded. We have a roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
The motion is approved unanimously, 5-0. The resolution has been adopted, approved, and filed sewer-only assessments, special assessment report, along with the collection of annual sewer charges for sewer-only accounts on the property tax rolls for fiscal year 2021. This concludes this public hearing, and I will now go to agenda item 2B. This is the time and a place set for a duly noticed public hearing regarding the collection of annual payments for Wine Country Special Benefit Area financing agreements on the property tax rolls for fiscal year commencing July 1, 2020. I declare this public hearing open and would ask a staff report on the proposed action. Thomas.
In November 2013, the district created a special benefit area in the Wine Country area of Temecula and established a special benefit area surcharge in order to spread the cost of construction of sewer infrastructure to area participants. The board authorized a financing program to assist property owners with the payment of special benefit area surcharges and certain financial participation charges associated with the connection to the Wine Country sewer system. On July 6, 2016, the board adopted Ordinance 2016-006, establishing the collection of these financing payments on the property tax roll commencing that year, July 1, 2016. In fiscal year 2019-20, the district levied 23 parcels for a total assessment amount of $246,177.61. As of July 1, 2020, the district has received 88% of the assessed levy. Approximately $30,000, or 12%, has yet to be received. These delinquencies relate to the most recent tax bill that was due April 10th, 2020. It is widely expected the contributing factors comprise of the economic impact COVID-19 has had on the travel, dining, and tourism industries. Staff will be reaching out to the delinquent wineries to discuss their plans for remitting the past due payments. The district will levy 23 parcels for the 2020-21 tax year for a total assessment amount of $246,177.50. Staff has prepared a Wine Country Sewer Infrastructure Financing Special Assessment Report per Health and Safety Code 5473 attached as Exhibit B. This report identifies each of the parcels to be charged as well as their amortized annual payment. This payment was filed with the Board Secretary on June 17, 2020, upon adoption of Resolution 2020-095.
Okay, I would ask the Secretary of the Board how this hearing was noticed.
The Wine Country Sewer Infrastructure Financing Special Assessment Report was filed with the Secretary on June 17, 2020. Notice of the filing of the report proposing to have annual Wine Country charges for the upcoming fiscal year collected on the tax roll and the time and place of this hearing was published in the Press Enterprise, a local newspaper, on June 30th and July 7th, 2020, in accordance with Government Code Section 6066.
I would ask if the Secretary of the Board has received any written protest to the proposal. I would ask her to provide copies thereof to the Board.
No written protests to the proposal have been received.
Thank you. Since members of the public have been invited to participate in this hearing telephonically, I would ask any members of the public who would like to comment on this item, please do so now. Please state your name and address for the record before commenting. Do we have anybody telephonically in that would like to speak on this? Hearing none. There have not been a protest made by the owners of the majority of the separate parcels of property described in this report. The board now has the option to adopt, revise, change, reduce, or modify any payments for this report. If no revisions are requested, we are ready to adopt the following resolution. The resolution of the Board of Directors of Eastern Municipal Water District approving the collection of annual payments for Wine Country Sewer Special Benefit Assessment Financing Agreements on the property tax rolls for a fiscal year commencing July 1, 2020. I will accept a motion and a second to adopt the resolution and the associated report.
Director Eckert, I'll move the item.
I'll second it.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Motion is approved 5-0 unanimously. The resolution that we have just adopted approves the filed Wine Country Sewer Infrastructure and Financing Special Assessment Report, along with the collection of annual payments for Wine Country Sewer Special Benefit Financing Agreements on the property tax rolls for fiscal year 2020 and to 2021. This concludes this public hearing, and we will now return to the next item on the agenda. With that, we'll go to agenda item 3, which is the executive reports.
Thank you, President Sullivan, members of the board, good morning. It's good to see you and hear from you, Director Record. My written report's included in your package. It was interesting to hear our first public comment today regarding local resource development, because you'll find on your water use efficiency, because you'll find in your board package today we have two items going on: landscape water use efficiency. I'm going to give you two reports on our key local resource development projects, specifically in the Paris North Basin, the groundwater remediation project, and of course our brackish desalination program. And to start with that, we had a very productive meeting last week with the Chief of Civil Works for the South Pacific Division of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and several members of her team. We found that periodic check-ins with the South Pacific Division are very important because they certainly make important recommendations to headquarters in Washington, D.C. regarding projects that should be completed in the work plan. Specifically, what we were advocating for in the meeting is a $4.7 million appropriation in the work plan for fiscal year 21. We would specifically use these funds to finance construction of transmission capacity in the Menifee area, which would actually allow us to bring more water to the DeSalter complex. As you recall, the Corps of Engineers did already fund three wells for us that we built as part of the DeSalter. Those wells are actually producing more water than we anticipated, and so we feel there would be beneficial to take some of the hydraulic constraints out of the system and be able to bring more water into the desalination complex. However, if we receive the $4.7 million, we're going to exhaust our federal appropriation or our federal authorization for this project. Our original authorization was for $25 million for the project, where the Corps of Engineers pays 75% of the project matching costs and Eastern pays 25%. Long term, what we really want to look at is expansion of the brackish desalination program. We think that groundwater basin has tremendous capacity. There's not much other pumping out of it. And the desalination technologies that we're using are very cost effective. And so one of the things we're focusing on is brine treatment technologies. And we've talked to this board about several pilot and demonstration projects we've done that are very encouraging, including the most recent one with Desalitech, which would allow us to take the brine discharge, which is about 25% of the water that comes into the plant is discharged as brine, treat that brine, recover more water, and also reduce our cost for discharging in the SAPA brine line. That is a costly technology to implement. It'd be a big investment for the district. So one of the things we're looking for is more support for the from the Corps of Engineers. So along those lines, we've been advocating for what's called a modification of our existing authorization. That's a process, a core process, which allows you to change the authorization to add scope to it and, of course, costs. And so we've been working with our congressional representatives and the Corps of Engineers to secure a modification. And this week, I'm happy to report that the House of Representatives released its version of the much-anticipated Water Resources Development Act, and we're very pleased to see in the WRDA bill our proposed modification language that would increase our authorization from $25 to $50 million. So we feel we're positioned very well. We do have an update later on our federal program by Jolene. She may want to go into more detail on that, but it was a really good milestone, and we continue to advance this project and the modification for future phases of the project. Under past and ongoing activities, I reported previously to the board regarding the Case Road sewer siphon repair. As you recall, last April, we had one of the siphons collapse under the road, caused a sinkhole. It's a fairly urgent item, but we needed to wait for the groundwater to recede before we could get in there and do the repair. We have been working with the city of Paris. As I reported at the previous board meeting, the city had taken a position that we needed to get city council approval for the complete road closure. They had said our other alternative was to just close one lane of Case Road. And Case Road's out here by the Paris Valley plant. If you're familiar, it kind of goes along the railroad tracks by the Paris Valley plant. We didn't feel that a single lane closure was safe. It's a very deep excavation. If you've been on that road, it's got V ditches on each shoulder that are very deep. I've driven home on that way. I've seen cars in those V ditches, and so we didn't feel like it was very safe, so we held out to get full closure of the road. We had a discussion with city staff and the city manager. I spoke to him last week and his staff. They're very understanding, but didn't feel that they could reverse the city's policy to take full road closures to the council. But what he was able to agree to was to schedule a special board meeting or a special council meeting, which occurred last night. The item, he had a couple of other items he put on the agenda, but there was three items in total on the agenda, and our item was approved on consent. As a result, this morning at 7 a.m., we started to put in the road closure, the traffic control for the road closure, and we will be initiating the excavation on that project before close of business today. So, you know, I think we really owe a big favor to the city manager for coming up with a creative solution, and we plan to send him a thank you letter, he and his staff, Richard Belmutis and his staff, for their assistance in this regard. On the Paris North Groundwater Contamination Remediation Project, we had our third Technical Advisory Committee meeting on the project last week with the State Board and Regional Board, meeting really focused on our modeling activities to support the design, the contamination remediation strategies, and the monitoring. The State Board and Regional Board are very supportive of what we're doing, and we're coming to closure with them on the design of the project. As far as an approach for the design of the project and where we would put the wells, production rates, where we would put the monitoring wells, et cetera. They did ask for additional information, however, on a well that we have on the southeast edge of the March Air Reserve Base, well 204. Their concern related to the PFAS contamination in the area, so we are going to be providing them some additional data on that. In addition, we also have a separate stakeholder advisory group, and that's a less of a technical group, but that includes representatives from the March Air Reserve Base, US EPA, Western, and the cities of Moreno Valley and Paris. We had a meeting of that group last week. They were, again, very supportive of the project and appreciate being brought up to speed. Subsequently, the MARB staff asked if they could also be on the technical advisory committee. And we agree that that would be really helpful for the project. So we communicated with General Coburn that we would like to have them on the technical advisory committee. In fact, it was probably an oversight to not invite them initially. And so we will be including them in the TAC in the future. And finally, on the project, we had a very constructive meeting with the city of Moreno Valley regarding placing one of our wells in one of two park sites. And the city's been very supportive of this. However, they're obviously concerned about footprint, size of the structure, noise impacts, aesthetics, and so forth. So we provided some of those details, and they're very supportive. And we're looking at one of two parks, Victoriano Park or I can't even pronounce this, Pedro Reina Park, that to put the wells on. They're looking at the different placement options there. And we will be moving forward that, but the city's been quite helpful, and we've been working through this with them, and so it looks like we will get another well site there. So overall, the program's got a lot of moving parts right now. Your board's approved previous contracts to finalize design for a substantial portion of the project. We have more coming forward because we need to be doing this under multiple contracts because of the time frame associated with the grant. But I do want to assure the board that overall the program continues ahead of schedule, and we're happy to report that things are moving forward nicely. So with that, if I can answer any questions. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I had one question. Going back to the South Paris Basin.
Yes.
Is there any effect on these water quality programs that individual developers, commercial and residential, you know, where they collect the water and don't let it drain out, at least in the kind of the first flush, in terms of the rising water, does it help to rise, you know, raise the aquifer, or does it degrade it?
That's a very good question, and I think it probably would require some technical analysis to look at to the extent they're using. And you're basically talking about the on-site retention systems, where essentially they are not connected to the drainage system off-site. They're retaining all for first flush flows, first quarter to a half inch of rain, and nuisance flows all collected on-site. Storm flows obviously go off-site. I think we would need to look at the location of those facilities and extent to which that and do some calculation. My gut tells me it's not a lot of water. But, you know, they do have a rising groundwater condition in that area in and around the base, and so I think it's a very good question. We could look into that if you'd like us to.
Plus I understand. Plus they, you know, the pesticides and oils and things are collected, and it's all, you know, percolated. site.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'd have to look at that. Compared to the quality of that groundwater basin already, I'm not sure that it would be substantial additional degradation. But we'll take a quick look at that and maybe come back to the engineering committee.
More of curiosity.
Yeah.
Maybe it's premature to even ask it because it's only been the last 5 or 6 years that people have really been constructing these facilities.
Okay.
We have any other questions of Paul?
Any other questions? Thank you for the time this morning.
Thank you. Laura?
Nothing today.
Nothing to report today.
All right. Sounds good to me. All right. We'll go to agenda item 4. I'll accept a motion and a second for approval of items 4A through 4I.
Mr. President, could I pull item F?
Sure. We have a motion and a second for the balance.
I will make the motion for the balance of the consent calendar, except for item F.
I'll second.
All in favor? Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Motion approved unanimously. Let's go to agenda item 4F, which is to approve and authorize a 2-year agreement with Quality Turf Incorporated of San Jacinto, California, for the agricultural land lease of approximately 140 acres of district property. So, Steve?
I just kind of wanted to understand a little better about how we went about doing this. It seems to me that the lease amount is extremely low. I talked to a few people as to what was being paid at other sod farms, and other sod farms are paying more than 6 times what this lease is. And even vegetable ground is $200 to $250 an acre. And Randy might know more than I do, but Ralph Daly, he owns Quality Turf. He's a really nice guy and everything, but I think we need to get the most we can for our lease amount. So,
sure. I can start out on this. There's about 190 acres of this property. As you recall, we acquired this property previously to provide a buffer around the San Jacinto plant to also provide the ability to do future expansion of projects such as our potable reuse project at the San Jacinto plant. This lease was in place when we bought the property. However, we did extend it in, 2014. And to Quality Turf, and so it is up for renewal. You know, our approach to this is we need to maintain those properties. If we didn't have a lessee on that property, we would be spending money to keep the weeds off the property, to maintain it, and so forth. And so we look at this as the lessee is responsible for full maintenance of the property and keeping it in a good condition. So we have similar leases for agricultural properties that are around the Paris Valley Water Reclamation Facility next door here. They're in the same range around $76 per acre. We have one at $50 per acre. And so we felt that it was comparable with those lease rates. And given the fact that he has been a very good lessee and has kept the property in good condition, we felt that this was an appropriate cost to go forward with. That being said, the original lease included the house as well as the property. He's had expressed an interest in purchasing that, and so we're having that appraised right now, and so it's not part of this current lease package.
So what is the, it's a two-year lease, and what happens after that? What is our plan?
Well, I think
I didn't see the actual lease document in the.
Well, I think we would renew the leases after 2 years, or look at, do we want to adjust the lease price? Do we want them put them out competitively? I have a feeling he would be very interested in leasing the property, particularly if he purchases the house and we agree to do that in the future. But if not, or if he's not interested in leasing, we would try to find another lessee. And again, of course, at that time, we could Sorry, I feel like I'm looking at, that time we could look at adjusting the lease price.
Yeah. I mean, I'd really like to look at re-advertising this somehow, because I just think it's pricey. I mean,
President Sullivan, can I make a few comments?
Sure. Director Record?
Steve, those are good questions, and I don't disagree with you, but, well, maybe I do. This is really not very good ground. It's definitely not vegetable ground. And we've got ground that we've been trying to lease, and it's a much better ground, and we're lucky to get $100 an acre for it. I'm farming ground that I get for nothing just to maintain it. According to the write-up, this was offered to all our recycled customers, and I'm not surprised that no one responded. The other part of it is it's pretty much short term, because we let it be known that we want to put more solar out there. So you know as well as I do how hard it is to really make investments and pay a lot of money for rent if you're not going to have the property for very long. So I think it is early in the process, and the lease goes to the end of the year. I don't have a problem if you want to re-advertise, but I don't think we're going to get anything different. So I'm fine with what this is.
Yeah, and
so it's marginal at best, then.
Yeah. Well, and as Director pointed out, you know, our Phase 3 solar initiative is going to use a portion of that property, and so that's why the two-year time frame on the lease, because it is a long-term commitment for that to be farmed property in the future. It has other district uses, which is why we
I think Ralph's done a good job farming it. I would never grow vegetables on it. I've never seen potatoes or onions or anything, even watermelons that are grown in San Jacinto Valley, grown on that piece of ground. So it's heavy ground, it's alkali, and I just don't think there's a lot of demand for it.
Okay. So it's a lot of alkali in it. It's kind of messed up.
Yeah, I mean, I, as I said, I think Ralph's doing a good job of growing turf on it. That's a challenging piece of property.
All right. Well, then I would take Randy's advice. I'll go ahead and make the motion to approve the lease.
Thank you.
I'll second it.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded for agenda item 4F. Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan.
Aye.
Director Pauly.
Aye.
Director Corona.
Aye.
Director Slauson.
Aye.
Director Record.
Aye.
Okay, motion is approved. Is approved unanimously.
With that,
we'll go to the action calendar 5A, which is to approve and authorize the general manager to enter into a memorandum of understanding with United Way for joint implementation of a low-income customer assistance program, and authorize up to $150,000 from the eligible revenue sources for first-year implementation of the program. Paul.
Thank you, President Sullivan. Members of the board, I'll be doing this presentation jointly with Jolene Walsh. Jolene, I assume you're on the phone. I hope you're on the phone.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Excellent. Very well. Thank you very much. So I'll go to slide 2 just to give a little bit of background and outline of this discussion. Early in January, the administrative committee members requested that we provide information at future meetings to look at possible development of special customer support programs using non-rate revenue, such as unclaimed monies. In fact, it was triggered by an item regarding unclaimed monies coming to the district. So we did a very substantial investigation on what different program options might be available. We also had to look at what funding sources would be Proposition 218 compliance that we could use for such programs, and really kind of tried to understand what programs we have currently at the district and what could we use to provide meaningful customer assistance. So based on that analysis, we did come back to the administrative committee at its direction on June 4th and discussed kind of in detail some program options. One of the options we looked at was enhancing our education programs and perhaps providing a scholarship program component. We did look, though, and the district provides a substantial number of educational offerings ranging from our partnerships with the universities to youth ecology. I mean, you go a very wide range, and we do have a very substantial investment in that area. So the other areas we explored included low-income customer assistance programs. And we looked at a variety of program designs, types. We looked at all the other agencies in the regions that do have programs. And we developed a set of policy principles, which we reviewed with the committee, and the committee concurred to. And we'll talk about those a little bit later in the presentation to guide a program design that Eastern may want to implement. So based on that, the committee directed staff to pursue the development of a low-income customer assistance program based on the policy principles and what was out there and what we felt were effective programs. Board directed us to model our program after the Coachella Valley Water District United Way program, so that's what we're going to be presenting today. We did go back to the committee on July 2nd with details of what the program would be, as well as the budget, and we are going to present that to you today. So kind of what really, going on to slide three, are our policy motivators for a customer assistance program. I mean, first, I think we need to recognize as an organization, we're a fairly leading voice, and both statewide and locally, that are addressing issues of water affordability and reliability. For example, we, of course, have our legislation, which really speaks to providing economies of scale and lower cost water service, meeting regulatory objectives in low-income communities. We've done our affordability study with UC Riverside, which is a real first-of-its-kind study looking at water affordability metrics at a very micro level within our service area. Also, we believe the program would demonstrate a real commitment to the customers as well as state agencies that we're sincere in our advocacy when we're talking about low-income assistance in Sacramento, and we're commenting on different types of programs that the state is proposing, which are not always good, that we have something to really back us up in terms of our commitment. It also really aligns with our strategic priorities to conduct not only effective communication advocacy, but community partnerships, and I think that's one of the things that sets this district apart from others, is the number of community partnerships that we have and the way we reach out to our customers. And then finally, I think it positions us to utilize state or federal funding to advance greater levels of assistance in the communities served by the district if we have a program structure in place. I think it's also important that we establish a program that we get to design versus the state of California. I think the trend is certainly leading towards an industry standard of having customer assistance programs. We can basically drive our own future if we get a program in place and really not be mandated to a structure that we may not like by the state of California. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jolene. She's going to go over kind of the funding sources, the policy principles, and then the specific elements of the customer assistance program that we're proposing with the United Way. Jolene?
Great. Thank you, Paul. On page four, you can see we looked at the funding sources with limited restrictions to fund such a program and found that the average annual revenue is about $735,000. We'll talk more about the program in detail, but we do think that about $150,000 will be sufficient for the first year of the program, and that would cover the assistance to the customers as well as the program administration costs. On to slide five, we started the effort, as Paul mentioned, by developing policy principles that include that the program must be Prop 218 compliant. That's pretty important and foundational. Also, that it does not require EMWD to possess sensitive customer data. We don't want any information about income or any other sensitive customer data. Like we just mentioned, utilize only non-operating revenue. The program management would not burden ENWB staff, provides a tax-deductible way for people to donate. We do actually get customers who call in and want to pay their neighbor's water bill or want to contribute, and we currently don't have a mechanism for that. The program would be first come, first serve. There's not unlimited funds. It would assist residential customers who need financial assistance and are struggling with paying their water bill, and it would offer a one-time assistance within a 12-month period. So it really is to help give customers a boost. It's not intended to be an ongoing assistance program. And then lastly, but we think is also very important, is that the customers must not be exceeding their water budget, so we're not subsidizing wasteful use. On to page six. In terms of program elements, staff recommends that EMWD partner with United Way as a third-party program administrator and execute an MOU with United Way. EMWD customer service representative would refer the delinquent customers to United Way for assistance. Customers would complete United Way's application. United Way would review and determine eligibility, and then customers would receive a credit of $100. Eligible customers would receive a $100 credit, and then late fees and any reconnection fees would be waived just for the month that the credit is provided. And as we already mentioned, it would be available once in a 12-month period. Moving on to slide seven. There's a lot of details in the customer eligibility, but just to highlight a few, the names have to match, the customer is getting the assistance with the name on the bill, the must be the customer's primary resident. It is only offered to residential customers. As I mentioned, customers can't be exceeding their water budget. They must also be delinquent. And they need to go through United Way for all the assistance, for the application, everything. We will not be the in-between for the customer in United Way. They must work directly with United Way. And then in terms of income, the customers must be at or below 200% of the U.S. Federal Poverty Guidelines, which is a pretty standard metric for assistance programs like this. On to page eight. The MOU in partnership with United Way. As I mentioned, United Way would process all the applications. They would have all the customer information. Once a customer is defined as being eligible, United Way would inform our customer service. Our team would place the $100 credit on the account and waive the fees. In terms of the fees that United Way would charge, they've requested a $50 annual fee plus a $5 per customer application fee, which represents about 5% of the overhead cost. On slide nine, there are some additional program elements. United Way would also set up a website for tax-deductible donations. They would all be, any donations for this would be put in a separate EMWD account under United Way's umbrella, and those funds would be earmarked specifically for the benefit of our program. And then United Way would develop the online portal so customers can go to the portal to apply as well as to donate. And then each month, United Way would send Eastern a statement that includes all the transactions. As Paul mentioned, United Way manages this same type of program for Coachella Valley Water District and six other water agencies in the desert. And their program is called Help to Others. And they've kind of given us the blessing to use the same program name and logo and such. So our program can just be an expanded version of the regional program, and we'd actually hope that others in the region would adopt something similar. On to slide 11, in terms of outreach, for the first 3 months, we're going to have a grace period to allow United Way to get their website up and running, get our website up so customers can connect to United Way through our website when they're looking for assistance. Of course, we take that first 3 months to develop the campaign branding and then develop talking points for our customer service team to use. We want to give them very succinct talking points to direct the customers to United Way immediately. We don't want our customer service reps taking time on the phone to explain the program. We really want it to be a quick transfer to United Way so United Way can take their time to explain the details. And then also in that first 3 months, United Way could reach out to disadvantaged communities to start generating some interest. And on slide 12, the full campaign beyond that 3 months, once we're up to speed, we would use every advertising and marketing tool that we have available, including all of our website and social media and our paper notices, whether it be a bill or an insert or the Prop 218 notice. But once that 3 month period has passed, we would make a big effort to make sure our customers are aware of this, not only from the perspective of taking advantage of the program as a customer in need, but also for people who are interested in donating. On to slide 13, the recommendation before you today is to approve and authorize the general manager to enter into a memorandum of understanding with United Way for joint implementation of a low-income customer assistance program and authorize up to $150,000 from the eligible revenue sources for the first year implementation of the program. And with that, are there any questions?
Any questions we can answer?
Director Slauson.
I have one question, or maybe two. Is there any sense of how United Way verifies income, or is it self-verifying?
Any sense of how they verify the income? Jolene, do you know, I know they do use an income verification process, particularly because we have to establish that the income is below 200% of the federal poverty level. But Jolene, do you have any more insight on that?
In my communications with United Way, those are some of the details we can hammer out in the MOU, but they said they have tools to verify income, and they're happy to utilize those. They did indicate that Coachella and the other water districts in the desert who have this same program, it is more of an honor system. So they, whatever the customer provide, they do trust that is accurate. But they did indicate that they have tools to verify if that's the route we'd like to go.
Okay, that sounds good.
And I can also look into what those tools are if you would like.
Okay, that sounds good. One other question. I like the program. If it looked like the three-year possible funds available was higher than 150 per year, if this ends up being really successful, can it be funded more than 150 this year?
Sure. I mean, we would come back to the board to get that authorization, but we do have, if you look at the total eligible revenue, and that eligible revenue is unclaimed monies, it's leases, cell tower leases, and some of the penalties that we charge. They add up to about $740,000 a year, about $737,000 a year, and kind of average on that level.
Per year.
So the amount of all those ground leases and everything, you put it all together, the prop the non-Prop 218 restricted revenues are at that level. So what we're looking at is something that's less than 25% of that. So we do have some headroom if the program is successful. However, we would come back to the board and seek that authorization.
I think this sounds great.
Do you have any other comments?
President Sullivan, I think this is a great program. It's very, it's a great idea and makes complete sense. I'd move the item.
Bill?
Second. Yeah, I just wanted to make one quick comment and then a question. I mean, first of all, just want to thank everybody involved in this, April and Jolene and the whole staff did a wonderful job. We, at the admin committee, laid out this is the program we think will work, and they figured out how to make it work real well. But since Charles is here, I just wanted to say one of the tasks we said is we do not want to burden Charles in that department. So do you think we've hit that goal on this program? Okay, this will not become a heavy lift for your folks?
No, we've been working with Jolene and the team, and it doesn't appear to be a heavy lift.
Okay, very good. All right. No, I just, again, congratulations. And as Paul stated, if we don't take the lead on this, I think our friends in Sacramento will help us take the lead on this, so I am glad that we are getting ahead of the curve on that. So,
sure, and I'd just like to make a comment. I just think the staff has done an incredible job to move this forward from the time that we kind of suggested this on the admin committee in January to today. I think it fulfills all the ideas that we had to have a better public outreach on some of these things that benefit not only some of the ratepayers, whether it's underprivileged or whichever, that it just makes the district stand out just for one more program that we do an exceptional job on, and that we have been an advocate for affordable water for everybody, and I think this helps fulfill some of those things that we do advocate for and some of our legislative aspects in Sacramento. And so I have nothing but praise for the staff on this particular one. And it seems to work extremely well in the desert because I have talked to a couple of the guys at Coachella Valley Water District. So with that, we have a motion and a second. Can we have a roll call, please?
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauley?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. We'll go to 5B, which is to adopt two resolutions establishing the assessment district assessments, community facilities, district special taxes, and general obligation bond tax rates on the property tax rolls for fiscal year 2020 to 2021.
Morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. Yes. The item before you calls for adopting two proposed resolutions relating to placing the assessment district assessments, community facilities district special taxes, and setting the GO bond tax rates on the property tax roll for fiscal year 2020-21. This is an annual process of the district where over the past several weeks, staff has worked with our special tax consultants, and in the next few weeks, we'll be working with the county to place the levies on the tax roll. Regarding assessment districts and community facilities districts, we've been very busy this past year, and so have developers. This year's levy amount is approximately $23.8 million, representing an increase of about $3.7 million over the prior year. The increase results from newly formed CFDs, the addition of newly developed parcels being taxed for the first time, and additional debt service arising from bond sales in the past year. All in all, 1,500 parcels are being added to this year's levy. Or an additional 1,500 parcels are being added. The approval of this resolution establishes a not-to-exceed levy and authorizes the county to place the levy on the property tax roll for fiscal year 2020-21. Regarding GO bonds, the district has issued GO bonds in 2005 and 2009 to help finance capital projects being replaced due to age or being upgraded to improve operations. The tax rates are required to be reported to the county, and we have not seen material changes to assess valuations, and as a result, staff recommends the GO bond tax rates remain unchanged over the prior year. The approval of this resolution sets the GO bond tax rates to be levied on the property tax roll for the fiscal year 2020-21. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
No, I have none.
No. I'll move the item.
Okay.
I'll second the item.
There's a motion and a second. Can we have a roll call, please?
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Motion approved unanimously. I just a little follow-up. I wonder at some point, this is what we actually collect every year. And I just wonder if there's some way that we look at that to say, you know, how much does this contribute to the economic development of Riverside County?
Yeah,
it'd be
so
something to have in our portfolio as we look at different things that we do look at.
Yeah, we definitely have the data, and we're required each year to report that data to CDAC, who manages public entities' debt and reporting requirements. So we report that information to the state each year, but it doesn't really specify, you know, what material changes are being made to the economic impact of the county. But we've been busy. You know, we've talked to developers in the past few months, and you know, amid COVID-19, they're still busy. They've made some concessions with model home tours and such, but you know, it's a hot market, and it doesn't look like it's stopping soon. One particular thing that will be interesting to see, and we discussed it in our admin committee, was the delinquencies for individual property tax or property owners. You know, right now we're not seeing any changes, but as homeowners are in forbearance periods right now, you know, that'll affect the next year's taxes, and so we'll keep a pulse on the delinquency rates there, and make sure we keep the board apprised of any developments.
Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you,
Sullivan. We
yes.
might be able to work with
Thank
Webb
you,
and find out if they know of any regional reporting where we can do some form of calculation to see the benefit. I'm not sure if there's such a report done, and maybe there's a proration that we can look at to evaluate that.
Yeah, I just think it would be helpful because there's not too many water districts that do this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's got to be a distinct advantage for using this kind of a program, and it would just be nice to have that in our quill.
Our tool belt. There.
Tool belt, yeah.
We'll do it and bring a report back to you.
Thank
yeah,
you
we'll bring something back to the admin committee on this.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you. Okay, with that, let's go to agenda item 5C, which is adopt the proposed Eastern Municipal Water District General Geographic Information System Master Plan.
Good morning, President Sullivan, members of the board, and those connected remotely. Today I'm here to present the Geographic Information System Master Plan, which was a co-opt effort between EMWD and SOMAS, an engineering firm that we hired for this engagement. So just generally on the topics we'll be discussing today, we're going to give you some background, talked about the process that we underwent in this evaluation and development of a master plan. We'll talk budget and then show you some of the potential benefits and outcomes. So we're going to be talking a little bit about a thing called Enterprise GIS today, and the reason for that is pretty simple. Enterprise means everyone contributes and everyone also gains from the work product. GIS is an enterprise tool, and our intent is to bring all the parties together that have an interest and need to use GIS data in their daily work so that we're all benefiting from this unique and collaborative solution. So to give you a basics on the timeline, in November 2018, we brought a item to the board to approve a master plan engagement with SOMAS. In May of 2019, we gave an update to the board on the progress that we had made since our conversion from a product called Small World to Esri ArcGIS in 2016. And finally, today as I stand before you, which is actually July 2020, we completed the final draft of the GIS master plan, and we're presenting that to you today. So, at a high level, the process involved taking stakeholders from 18 different departments. We had over 40 folks that were interviewed by SOMAS, as well as some key EMWD staff. We took that input from the stakeholders, and it didn't involve just, you know, how do you use GIS today? It was also kind of an opportunity for folks to soundboard and talk about what GIS can bring to their group and how it can improve their daily work. And from that, they were able to elicit some more information from those individuals to figure out how GIS can improve their business. Secondly, SOMAS performed several assessments. Chief of those assessments was data quality. That's always a continuing concern when you've got a large set of data that we've been using and contributing to for 50 plus years now. Data quality is something you've always got to chip away at. It's never going to be perfect, but you need a way to measure it and make sure that you're staying on track. We looked at the technology platform and our integrations with other systems. We looked at procedures around how we update data and also consume data from GIS. And finally, our ability to support and coordinate efforts around GIS, which means can end users get to the data they need? Do they understand how to use the data? Are we kind of following from the same playbook? And finally, you know, periodically through this process, SOMAS also consulted numerous times with an executive steering committee that we put together to help kind of drive overall vision. And GIS subject matter experts, of which EMWD has several dozen folks who work with GIS and really understand our data in a way that helped inform the information that's going into this master plan. So although SOMAS noted that we had made significant progress since our 2016 conversion from Small World, there were some key findings that I want to bring to the board today. And again, as I alluded to earlier, data quality is a challenge for everyone when it comes to GIS, but SOMAS saw some opportunities for us to shore that up and do a better job of not only data entry, but also measuring and fixing data problems in our GIS system. Secondly, most treatment facility assets are not in GIS, and that's problematic because we have a lot of capital tied up in these facilities, and we should be tracking them in GIS and managing those assets in that system. Also, they found opportunities for us to clean up our data management processes, so we're eliminating duplicate steps, double data entry, updating two systems with the same information. These things don't make sense for an efficiency perspective and also from a data accuracy perspective. You enter the data once, you do a really good job at it, and you're done. Also, low mobile workforce GIS utilization, and that really boils down to, do the folks out in the field, the field staff, are they able to use this GIS data in their daily work? And the answer right now is not so much. And although EMWD staff were aware of that, what we wanted to do was, you know, put the horse before the cart, get our data issues resolved first, so that the folks out in the field, when they do have access to these tools, they know they can rely on the data and they trust the system. Lastly, a fragmented array of technologies, which is just a byproduct of each working group trying to find the best way to do their work. And sometimes it means finding their own solution. So now we need to bring that all together and figure out, okay, are we all marching in the same direction? Are there multiple systems deployed that are basically doing the same function? Let's eliminate those, simplify the solution so it's easier to manage moving forward. So we've got two slides on key recommendations. I'm on slide 10 now. for those remote. And this first slide on recommendations is basically about accessibility and accuracy of the data. So the first key recommendation from SOMAS was implement GIS as an enterprise resource. So that improves internal coordination, access to information in the system, and also enhances sustainability of the GIS program, all the things that I've been speaking to up to this point. Secondarily, integrate GIS with other related business systems. Although our GIS system is already connected to other enterprise systems, like our computerized maintenance management product and CityView for planning and permit, the goal is that you identify each piece of data and you identify its system of record. You shouldn't be duplicating that information anywhere else. So we need to improve those integrations so the data lives in the system of record, it's updated in the system of record, but from all these district enterprise systems, it's very easy to access that information. Single click, you don't have to run to 10 different applications to find what you need. And finally, focus on GIS data quality. Implement quality control processes. Set standards and make sure that people are following those standards in their daily routine to make sure the data stays as good as it can be. And the second slide, on slide 11 here, the second set of key recommendations are basically around efficiencies. So SOMAS was talking about reducing data and process redundancies. So find more efficient ways to do what we do today. Some of the procedures that we do, especially for data entry in our GIS system, are carryovers from, you know, 30, 40 years worth of engineering work. Expand GIS access to non-technical stakeholders. So GIS as a resource can help everyone. They don't have to be a GIS expert, and they don't necessarily have to know that, you know, understand all the data underpinning the GIS system. They need task-focused tools to be able to get their job done in the most efficient way possible. And then finally, engaging existing and potential users to help them solve real business challenges by leveraging the appropriate data and tools. So that's a lot like customer outreach. You talk to the customers, you find out if there's gaps in their needs, and you try to address them. So on to the projects and the schedule for what was proposed in the GIS master plan. We're on slide 13. There were 37 master plan initiatives identified. And of those, the district had already been in the process or completed 11 of those 37 master plan initiatives. I spoke earlier about our conversion from Small World in 2016 to Esri ArcGIS. And after completing that conversion, you know, a lot of the folks that were using the GIS data said, you know, we've got issues with our data, and we need to get a working group assembled to look at this, to prioritize our work and figure out how to address it, because there was a lot of work to be done. So in 2016, we put together kind of an ad hoc committee of technical experts to start working on these items. And, you know, we were hitting the mark, as shown here, 11 of those initiatives were actually generated from EMWD subject matter experts, and we were already working on them by the time SOMAS came and assisted us with this master plan. The planning horizon for the GIS master plan portfolio is through 2024, and the focus, as always, is let's look at our strategic priorities, and let's make sure that we're addressing those through this initiative. And there are three distinct project phases that were proposed in this master plan. First is let's develop the foundation. Let's make sure we've got a very good foundation to build on. Second is strengthen and sustain GIS. And third is build and extend that GIS environment. And here you'll see a schedule where we have those three different phases identified on slide 14. The foundation phase, it says build the eGIS team, and you'll see that shows that that item was already underway, and that was essentially our ad hoc technical committee. And those folks were primarily responsible for working on standardizing and fixing our existing data. So you'll see that under the strengthen phase, that item is also underway. So we're looking to close those two things out by roughly the middle of calendar year 2022. And the remainder of the items are either finite period, closing out in fiscal year 2024, or ongoing support. And at the bottom of this GIS master plan schedule, in the operational support, the deploy tools, and train and automate tasks, those items are all showing as ongoing efforts. These are the things that we have to continue to do throughout the life cycle of our GIS environment to make sure that it is relevant to the business and that it serves the need. On to the GIS master plan budget. We're now on slide 16. We are asking for no net funding authorization increases through this process. We don't anticipate any increase to district staffing levels. And you'll see we show a chart here of five-year spend. The first column is the fiscal year 2019-2020 spend, essentially the most recent closed fiscal year. And you'll see that the program costs are very much leveled. And what we did was we staged and we reorganized the master plan projects in that portfolio to make sure that we didn't have this huge expenditure bubble. And we're doing it in a way that allows us to essentially address all these master plan items without this significant uplift in budget. So now on to master plan benefits and outcomes. SOMAS identified $140,000 in yearly labor savings for the Water Resources and Conservation Department. And most of that stems from the fact that today, our Water Resources and Conservation folks, when they need to generate a new hydraulic model, they need to export the data from our current GIS system. They need to hand massage and modify that data and then import it into their hydraulic modeling tool. And the intention is, let's fix the data natively in GIS so that export is ready to use in the hydraulic modeling software. And that is every 1 to 2 years when they do that process, it's a lot of manpower that's required to get that done. Engineering services, we've got $84,000 in yearly labor savings and $51,000 in contractor savings. Most of that stems from legacy data management and update processes. We're actually maintaining and updating parcel maps when what we need to do instead is adopt Riverside County parcel maps and then feed back to Riverside any data issues so that we're helping them fix their data and we no longer have to maintain our own copy of the parcel map. Information systems, they identified $17,000 in yearly labor savings there, and that's mainly due to consolidations. You know, we're talking about that sprawl of all these different technologies over time that were deployed to address GIS needs. And when we bring those systems together and consolidate and eliminate systems that aren't needed, we get savings from that. And then finally, but probably most significantly, is field operations. When we get these tools out to the folks doing the work in the field, especially when it's short order work, you know, if I'm doing the same type of task half a dozen times a day or a dozen times a day, if I have a very efficient tool at my fingertips to do data entry, to enter work orders, etc., every time I do that task, I'm saving time. And that can add up to a whole lot of saved employee time. On the order of roughly $600,000 of yearly labor equivalent. And this one, I apologize to the folks calling in remotely, but this is a live video about the outcomes for Esri ArcGIS products being deployed as an enterprise resource.
My name's Bill Thompson. I'm the general manager of White House Utility District, and we are a water and sewer provider across three counties. One of our biggest challenges is water loss, and It's traditionally a big problem for all water systems, and it's becoming a bigger problem with aging infrastructure.
We've got several areas of our...
We're not going to make you watch it from the beginning again. So I'll see if I can jog us to where, roughly where we are.
Oh, that's where it was.
Yeah? Thank you, Paul.
Right there. Structure.
We've got several areas of our staff that need to respond during a water main break. We've got engineering folks. We've got operations folks. We've got customer service folks that all need to be able to respond and know what is going on with the other groups in real time.
Every employee at White House has access to GIS and uses a map. What we've been able to do with ArcGIS is actually streamline a lot of our work processes so that we're not duplicating and triplicating information.
With the implementation of ArcGIS online and the executive dashboards, I can see what's happening almost in real time. So I can see the amount of work, how it's distributed, and where the people are. I can also see how they're accomplishing the work. So I can make recommendations back to the managers as to things they can do to improve productivity, things they can do to redistribute work.
Using the ArcGIS platform, the field staff can create an outage polygon to let customer service and our customers know exactly what areas are out of water, and then also let them know when they could potentially be back on.
ArcGIS has helped us with our capital improvement projects. One of the things we've been able to do is integrate GIS with metering equipment and project where we're having losses. That allows us to make better capital improvement decisions that are not a guess. A good case in point, we were able to postpone a bond issue because of ArcGIS. Effectively, it saved our customers about $32 million.
White House Utility District has a truly GIS-centric vision now and for the future. We're excited to start using ArcGIS Pro for 3D hydraulic grade analysis to be able to educate customers and contractors about some of the topographic problems that they may be having with water pressure.
Most of our customers, when we talk to them about pressure, if we can represent something in three dimensions, we think we'll be able to convey the points to them better, and they'll appreciate that visualization.
Lastly, we'll move on to master plan next steps. So the recommendation here is to create an EGIS team within information systems, create an EGIS executive steering committee, which will essentially set priorities and vision for implementing this portfolio of projects, and also managing GIS moving forward. Establish a cross-functional EGIS coordination group. These are the subject matter experts that can help us set standards and provide operational support. And implement the GIS master plan projects through 2024. And lastly, but most importantly, is continue to maintain and enhance EMWD's GIS services. Our recommendation to the board is to adopt the EMWD Geographic Information System Master Plan as presented by staff, and any large projects or individual contracts over $100,000 would come back to the board for authorization at that time. With that, any questions? I'd be happy to answer.
No, I don't have any questions. I just have one comment. I think what's going to make this program work effective is that this really is from the bottom up needs and synthesize that data to the top, rather than some genius from the top saying this is how it's going to work. Having done some of these things before in my prior life, it just makes for a successful program the way that you have this approach. And to have the all the employees a part of this design is going to make this a very effective program. My guess is the savings that you've shown here is going to be very conservative.
Yeah, I agree, Director Sullivan. Thank you for making that comment. And I think that's really indicative of that bottom-up approach based on the fact that SOMAS had identified 37 master plan initiatives, and we had, based on our what I'll call our power users of GIS on a day-to-day basis, our direct user staff had really initiated 11 of those before the recommendations came out. And I think Mike's provided kind of great leadership in his orientation towards kind of let's see what the end user needs and build up from there has been a positive attribute of this project. I do also want to emphasize we asked Mike and his and the group who's working on this to really look at the budget. We're very budget conscious on this. We have projected expenditures for GIS that have been included in our budgets. And we have looked at over the next 4 years, making sure that those expenditures really fit within what we were anticipating in our budgets, which of course our rates and charges are built on. And so we're not asking for any increased spending levels based on the staggering of certain activities and the prioritization of certain activities that Mike and his fellow employees put together for this project. So, you know, we're very pleased that we're going to accomplish this after a long period of time, but we are very conscious of the budget, and we do not want to break the budget. And so the expenditure plan that we have proposed for the master plan does not need a separate budget authorization as a result of that. Thank you.
I'll move the item, Mr. President.
Second. It's been moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauley?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Thank you very much, Mike. With that, let's go to agenda item 6, which is the information items. We'll have agenda item 6A, which is a discussion of the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2020 annual audit. Good morning. I have the same problem.
Hope you can hear me from here.
Down.
There you go.
There we go.
Okay.
Thank you.
Can you hear me? Oh, there you go. Thank you. Good morning, members of the board. Good morning, everyone. As a background to the fiscal year ended June 30, 2020 annual audit, Davis Farr is performing the district's financial statement and single audits for the fiscal year ended June 30, 2020. This is their sixth year of audit engagement with the district. This year they have a new audit partner in charge, Shannon Ayala, replacing Jennifer Farr, who has been the audit engagement partner for the past 5 years. This is part of their 5-year audit rotation policy. So professional auditing standards require that the auditors communicate their planned scope of the audit timeline, and significant audit findings. On their audit planning letter, which is Exhibit A, they outline auditor responsibilities and also include some examples of inquiries they plan for the audit that may impact the risk assessment of the district's financial statements. Some of these inquiries include matters related to possible misstatements in the accounting records or weaknesses in internal controls. They also mention on page 2 some additional testing they plan to perform during the audit. These testings include the risk of errors in estimating pension and OPEB liabilities. They also plan to meet with management regarding impact of COVID-19 on the district's revenue and expenses, and they also plan to do additional testing on revenue and expenses that may have been impacted by COVID-19. This year, they also have an element of surprise in the audit, which they have every year. This year's element of surprise is testing the detailed list of checks disbursed during the fiscal year with the bank statements to ensure the accuracy and completeness of the district's financial records. Lastly, you will find on Exhibit B the audit timeline. It includes significant audit dates, such as the preliminary audit, which was completed in April of this year, that was completed online. We also have the final audit and the single audit scheduled in August, and the audit presentation in December. Thank you, and with that, I'm open for any questions.
You have any questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
With that, let's we'll let Charles stick around to have a donut. It'll take about a 10-minute break before we get into the couple of items that will take a little bit of time. So with that, let's take a 10-minute break.